everyone, and welcome to today's SeedWorld Innovation Webinar Series. My name is Alex Martin, and I serve as an associate editor for SeedWorld, and today I'm happy to be your host. Today's theme is Nematode Management 2020 Outlook, Understanding Pests, Risks, and New Technology. Before we begin, we'd like to thank New Farm for partnering with us on today's webinar. In today's webinar, you'll learn how nematode populations are spreading and presenting risks within soybeans, corn, and cotton. We'll also get some hints on how to scout and test for nematodes and how to analyze nematode counts and gauge whether treatment is cost efficient. Finally, we'll gain tips for implementing a practical nematode defense program, and we'll learn about new seed treatment technology along the way. And during the presentation, you're likely going to have some questions for our speakers. Please type these questions into the chat box at any time during the webinar, and we'll address them during the Q&A session we'll hold after each speaker finishes their presentation. Also, during the presentation, we'll have a few poll questions for you. These will pop up in your chat box for you to answer. And don't worry, these questions will be completely anonymous. Also, we wanted to let you know that today's webinar is being recorded and will be made available at seedworld.com following the proceedings. We will also be sending out an email with a link to the webinar later after the webinar is posted. Well, we have quite a few speakers today. So presenting our webinar today is Dr. Gregory Tilka, professor at Iowa State University. Dr. Tamara Jackson-Zims, professor at University of Nebraska-Lincoln, Dr. Kathy S. Lawrence, a professor at Auburn University, and Dr. Tom Kroll, Seed Treatment Product and Technical Services Manager at New Farm US. Our first speaker of the afternoon is Dr. Gregory Tilka. Greg is a professor at Iowa State University, where he conducts research with a major focus on the soybean cyst nematode. His current research includes the study of soybean cyst nematode resistant soybean varieties, the effects of nematode protectant seed treatments, and interactions between soybean cyst nematode. Greg also serves as director of the Iowa Soybean Research Center at Iowa State University. Well, thanks for joining us today, Greg, and take it away. We're excited to hear from you.
Well, thank you very much, Alex. It's a good introduction to the topic, and so it's nematodes and soybeans, and in the Midwest in particular, the top of the list for those concerns are the soybean cyst nematode, and it is rated pretty consistently over the past several decades as the most damaging not only nematode, but soybean pathogen in North America, and second most damaging in the entire world. And so in the table you see there on the screen, the various pathogens and diseases listed on the left, the most recent yield loss estimates in the middle column are in a publication with Allen as the first author. The citation, if the listeners, the viewers, wanted to type in that DOI number at the bottom, you could actually go to the actual research report. It shows the top 10 in order for North America or the US. And then the column on the right is a little older of a publication that ranks the pathogens and diseases worldwide. And you can see soybean cyst nematode is number two. If there was a quiz portion of this webinar, I would query everybody and ask them what they thought was number one. But I'll just go ahead and dispense of the suspense and say it's soybean rust ranks number one in that particular survey, at least. But soybean cyst nematode is top of mind should be top of mind for soybean farmers in the Midwest. But it's not the only concern. We are beginning to learn, or learning now through research primarily out of Wisconsin, that the root lesion nematode, Pratelinchus, may be a hidden soybean yield robber in Midwestern soybean production, and that's from work of Dr. Ann McGoodwin at the University of Wisconsin. And then I have to credit my Southern colleagues and friends, including speaker today, Kathy Lawrence, who battle a different set of nematodes with soybean production in the Southern United States, namely the root knot nematode and the reniform nematode, who can be as serious of a yield robber as soybean cyst nematode. And it's more difficult to manage in the South because those two nematodes can reproduce on other crops in the rotation. Whereas you'll hear a little bit later with soybean cyst nematode in the Midwest, soybeans are generally grown in alternating years with corn, and corn is a non-host. They don't have the benefit of non-host crops for root knot nematode and reniform nematode as much in the Southern United States. So the reason soybean cyst nematode is or should be public enemy number one among Midwestern soybean producers is illustrated in this photograph. And this is not uncommon, an uncommon occurrence in years where moisture and rainfall is limiting and temperatures are really high. And if you see this kind of damage, if you want to put numbers to it, here are some research-based numbers. And what I'm showing on the left in the red bar is the average yield of resistant soybean varieties compared to, in the blue bar, average yield of susceptible varieties. And there's a 50% difference in those two bars. And if that's how you define yield loss, then it's a 50% yield loss. And so that is extreme damage that's always a possibility when the environmental conditions are proper for this to occur. But a bigger problem in the Midwest is illustrated in this photograph. In the background, you see healthy looking soybeans growing. And the problem is that you dig up the roots of these healthy looking plants and you find the insert photograph that I'm showing there. You still find lots of nice white plump females full of hundreds and hundreds of eggs. And this translates into yield loss as well. And the yield loss that's typical in these scenarios are shown in this bar graph, where resistant soybean varieties would yield 79 bushels per acre and the susceptibles 72 bushels per acre. And that doesn't seem like very much, and visually it doesn't look like very much, but that's 7 bushels per acre or 10% yield loss, even under no apparent above ground damage. The last thing I want to point out about the red bar showing here is these are resistant varieties in a mild year, and notice the yields were up around 79 bushels per acre. But when the previous graph was up with the two bars, the resistant yields were 15, 20 bushels per acre less. So the point here is that even resistant soybean varieties suffer yield loss. So no one should consider resistance as an absolute cure for soybean cyst nematode, but it's a good management tool, as illustrated by these different yields that I'm showing. And the ultimate point to emphasize to farmers and to agronomists who advise farmers is, no matter what things look like above ground, as you see here in the two scenarios I presented, below ground, the soybean cyst nematode life cycle continues to churn or turn, and we get a new generation of SCN every 3.5 to 4 weeks once we hit warm summer temperatures. And so numbers are building up no matter what things look like above ground. So soybean cyst nematode is also a problem because it's so widespread. And at Iowa State, we currently are the keeper of the official national map of where soybean cyst nematode has been found in North America. And this on the screen is the most recent map. It's a couple years old, but I'm happy to report that there's only one or two newly infested counties not represented on this map. And that map is published in the publication citation you see at the bottom of the screen. And again, if you go to that DOI number, you'll be able to find the publication and the maps. Most notable is we see new counties popping up in North Dakota, South Dakota, parts of northern Minnesota. And then surprisingly, we're now starting to see SCN in the state of New York. And that was first ever reported and discovered in 2016. So It's reflected in this 2017 map. So soybean cyst nematode is certainly widespread, and it's not going to go away anytime soon. And so we really need farmers to be aware of it and get in the mindset of actively managing the nematode. And active management consists of three strategies at the moment, and they are all equally important. The first strategy is to grow non-host crops, and we're fortunate in much of the soybean belt in the upper Midwest that, as I mentioned earlier, we're alternating between corn and soybean crops. Anytime that a corn crop is grown or other non-host crops, nematode numbers are going to drop. Some of the eggs are going to hatch, releasing their juvenile nematodes, and those juveniles are going to starve. And there's no way those juveniles that hatch in a year that a non-host crop is growing are going to be able to survive to next year's soybean crop. So growing non-host crops is a vital part of keeping our nematode numbers in check. Equally important is growing SCN-resistant soybean varieties. They've worked wonderfully for 2.5-3 decades. They're starting to lose their effectiveness because most soybean varieties that farmers have to pick from have the same set of resistance genes, and it's from a breeding line called PI88788. And we have research results that document quite clearly that nematode populations, SCN populations throughout the Midwest are building up the ability to reproduce on PI88788, which is why the advice is to grow varieties with different sources of resistance. And really the only other widely available source of resistance or type of resistance is called Peking, and that's listed there under the second bullet. And then finally, we have a brand new tool in the toolbox that is nematode protectant seed treatments. And there are several different options currently to pick from. There's going to be continuing options, I think, in the future. And they're a much needed additional tool in the toolbox to help bolster, in particular, the performance of the SCN-resistant soybean varieties that continue to erode. The performance continues to erode over time. So in summary, hopefully you've got a feel for kind of what the situation is with soybean cyst nematode. I want to point out there's a national education effort called the SCN Coalition. The website is shown here. And if you go to this website, you'll find state-specific management recommendations and the names of experts that you can turn to for more information on soybean cyst nematode.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Greg. And now, please don't forget, if you have a question for Greg or any of our other speakers as we keep going, go ahead and type that in the chat box as soon as you think about it, and we'll address it during the Q&A session of our webinar. Our next speaker of the day is Dr. Tamara Jackson-Zims. Tamara is a professor at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where she is responsible for statewide extension programming and research on established and emerging diseases of corn and sorghum. She is interested in applied research leading to improved disease diagnostics and management strategies to minimize loss of yield and quality. Tamara, I'll go ahead and hand it to you, and we're excited to hear what you have to say today.
Thank you, Alex. I appreciate it, and thank you to Nufarm for the invitation to talk about one of my favorite topics, and that's nematodes of corn. And there's a lot to talk about nematodes in corn, and I think one of the things that I want to start with is that to acknowledge that for many people, we've been led over the decades to imagine that nematode damage in corn might look something like this in a cornfield, where you've got a spot of varying size, where you've got some devastating stunting and some really poorly growing plants out there. And that's true, that can happen. And often, you know, those plants may look something like that. and the plants in the very middle might be very, very poor quality. And indeed, some nematodes can cause that level of damage. In the pictures that I've provided, these are sting and needle nematode damaged fields. And the reality is, though, that this level of damage is actually pretty rare. It's quite uncommon. But this is the image that I think most people think about, and that above ground damage is also usually accompanied by some really severe root damage below ground, and we can't discount that, and we should be carrying that shovel out to the field with us and digging those up and looking closer, because the roots can give us a lot of clues as to what is going on. The other misconception that we may have is that nematode damage is rare, when in reality, I think that many of us would agree that nematode damage is probably much more common than you might expect. And it may look more like what you see in this photo. And so, you know, overall, the corn looks pretty good out there. But if you look closely, you can see some yellow patches. And if you were out there closer and were able to go in those patches, you'd notice some of those plants were stunted and they were yellow. And this is probably a much more common scenario that you might encounter across Nebraska or many other parts of the country. And so from the nematode samples that we collected from this field and processed, we learned that there's a number of types of nematodes out there. I listed four of them here, and there were actually more than that, and that is not uncommon. It's actually quite common for us to process samples that have six or more different types or genera of nematodes out there. In this particular field, we actually had a nematode trial out there. Overall, the field yielded an average about 180 bushels per acre. And that's lower than I think we would expect from an irrigated cornfield at that time. But I can tell you that in those yellow stunted areas where we had the higher densities of nematodes, yield was as low as 30 bushels per acre. And so there was a lot of variability across there. And that might not be what you might expect if you think that nematode damage should look much more severe. And so I would just lobby that we look more closely at those. The problem is, though, that diagnosing and recognizing nematode damage can be complicated and tricky, in that you may also have fields that look like this, where it sure does look a lot like what I showed you earlier, where you've got a patch in the field where the plants in the middle are looking very unthrifty, yellow, chlorotic, stunted. And when you dig the roots up in this field and look like I did, the roots look to be in pretty poor condition too. And I was called out there by a farmer who was told that he had a nematode problem by both his seed company agronomist and a co-op that he purchased fertilizer from. When we ran those nematode samples, we got little to nothing in there. And so when I reported back, he was quite skeptical that it wasn't nematodes, because he had been told by two other parties that that's what was causing it. And so we revisited the field. And actually, what I didn't mention is we also split that sample in half and sent half of that sample away to a soil testing lab. And we did that a second time too. And both times we learned that that field had a very, very low pH. And in this type of soil, this was a sand, silicate sand, and the aluminum that was released at that low pH was very toxic to the plants. But it was misdiagnosed repeatedly by experts, and no sample was ever submitted for nematode analysis. And so I wanted to use that as an example to everyone that diagnosing a nematode problem can be tricky. And part of that is because the types of symptoms that you might see caused by nematodes can vary a lot, you know, from the yellow plants that I mentioned and the stunting that's very common, to some below ground symptoms, necrotic tissue, lesions on those roots, like you see in that photo in the lower right hand corner. These plants can have uneven height, uneven tasseling. And when you look closely at the roots, they might be misshapen. They could have excessive branching like the ones in the photo do, or they may have strange shapes or knots or galls Greg mentioned earlier, the root knot nematode, for instance. And in the southern states, that's an important problem in corn too. But sometimes we just have yield loss and there's no obvious sign pointing us to nematodes as the cause. And so I wanted to share with you that part of the problem with diagnosing nematodes or recognizing the damage is that we're working with a lot of different types of nematodes out there. And the list on this slide just shows you a sampling of some of the common ones out there. And I used to joke that if you can think of a weapon, that there's probably a nematode named after it. And some of these will probably look familiar to you, and it's not uncommon, again, to have multiple ones in the same field. What you might not realize, though, is that each one of these is from a different genus that often has a very long and ugly name, like you see on the right-hand side here. And within that genus, you also see SPP at the end, and that means that some of them also have multiple species of each one of these nematodes. Greg pointed out earlier the root lesion nematode. That one's down toward the bottom of this list, Pratelenchus. We know now that there are six or more species of the Pratelenchus nematode alone that can feed on corn. And we know that it can be a very important nematode for us here in Nebraska and elsewhere across the country. And so this complicates what we're talking about, and the fact that there are so many different kinds contributes to the diversity of symptoms that we can also see. The other thing you should know is that these nematodes have a lot of other characteristics that make them very different from each other. Nematologists like us, we group things, and in this case, we group them according to how they feed. And so most of the nematodes, about two-thirds of them on the top of the list, are what we would consider ectoparasites. They move around freely in the soil. They use the stylet or the hollow spear in their head to feed on those roots as they're moving along. They may push their head a short distance inside the root while they're feeding. But then there's other nematodes, the endoparasites at the bottom. That includes that root lesion nematode that I mentioned and the root knot nematode that you might encounter in the southern states. These nematodes can go inside the roots. The root lesion nematode even continues to move around. And you can imagine the type of damage that it's doing once it's inside, moving around and feeding and reproducing. And some of those nematodes can spend their entire lives inside roots. And so the diversity of how these nematodes feed even complicates further how we should collect samples, how a lab should process them, and how we might interpret the results. And so those are things that we should take into account. Something else that you might not be aware of is that when we look at nematodes too, here's some more diversity for you. These nematodes, although mostly microscopic, and you won't be able to see them usually with the naked eye, they actually vary a lot in size. And so for reference, you may have remembered that photo that Greg showed earlier of the soybean cyst nematode females on the soybean roots. That female is in the lower right-hand corner of this diagram, and you can see her only because she's round and colored, white to yellow to brown as she dies. The other nematodes you're not going to see hanging off of a root, though. They're very, very thin, and many are much shorter. The longest one is the needle nematode up there at the top of that diagram, and notice she is folded in half. And although it's a very large nematode, you're still not going to see them unless they're in a dish of water alone. That nematode, the needle, and one of the ones right below it, the sting nematode, caused the damage I showed you in the early pictures. Those are some of the ones that cause the most devastating level of symptoms, but again, they're rare. And it probably contributes to the stereotype of expecting nematode damage to be in sandy soil. And that's because the size of those nematodes makes them require sand soils because they need the large pore spaces between the sand grains to move around. And so that's why they need at least 80% sand. The other nematodes largely really don't have a preference for soil texture. And so many of them are very small, like the lesion nematode, and can be in any soil type. And so for you to really know what you have, you're going to need to collect a sample and send it to a nematode diagnostic laboratory. And I would contact that laboratory to find out whether they want soil in addition to roots or if they want just the root fragments in your soil sample. And so the timing of when you collect that might matter too. Because we have nematodes that travel deeper in the soil and sand, we recommend sampling sandy fields early in the season by about the fifth or the sixth leaf stage. And if you want to get more information on sampling, you can use your QR scanner on your phone and snap a photo of that image there, and it'll take you to a video that we produced here in Nebraska about nematode sampling. And remember that the results that you get back might be difficult for you to interpret, but you should remember that you should expect to see nematodes represented in every one of those nematode analysis, because there are plant parasites in every field. There's also beneficial nematodes out there too. And really what matters whether or not you have a problem is which ones are there and how many there are. We also like to emphasize that I think all of us would agree that we don't like to use the word threshold. The numbers that you see should probably be used more as guidelines, because those numbers are somewhat fluid and vary from field to field and year to year. Much of that is related to the characteristics of those fields and how much stress they're under. And so there's other factors we take into account when we make recommendations on whether or not you might need a nematicide, for instance. And so that information is very important as well when you submit a sample for processing to those laboratories, as well as the crop rotation, the presence of irrigation, and some other factors. So hopefully this will help you keep in mind that there's a lot of diversity out there in nematodes affecting corn, and we could talk for another hour or more just about those, digging in more. This is just scratching the surface of them. And Alex, I believe that's all I've got, and I'll turn it over to our next speaker, Kathy.
Perfect. Thanks so much, Tamara. So our third speaker of the day is Dr. Kathy S. Lawrence. Kathy is a professor at Auburn University, where her areas of expertise include soil-borne and foliar fungal diseases, specifically plant parasitic nematodes and fungi attacking field crops, vegetables, and ornamentals. She aims to develop and evaluate ecologically based plant disease management programs for the economically important crops and deliver these programs to growers. Thanks for joining us today, Kathy, and I'll let you take it away.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you. I'll start off with a slide from Magali at LSU. He shows some beautiful pictures of nematodes that we do have in the southern region. Now, there's a lot of nematodes on here, and they do exist in our area, but the main ones we battle most of the time are the reniform nematode, the root knot nematode, and the soybean cyst. So we do have quite a few, but those are our three major players. Now, for symptoms that we see here in the South, you notice the top slide is soybeans and the bottom slide is cotton. And our root knot nematode, which is most often for us, Meloidogyne incognita, in our areas, it does cause irregular areas in the field with stunted growth. I often call this the wave effect. You notice how the plant's growing up and down. And in the cotton, you'll often see small areas where there's very little growth. And then later in the season, we tend to have quite a few weeds. When you dig up those roots, and it does take a shovel, as Tamara said, you got to dig them up, and you'll notice there's not a lot of roots on those cotton plants. And you can see the galls that are very visible. So we have a lack of roots developing, and then the nematodes are causing the galling. And then on the left-hand side, you can see the tip of the root. It's galled, and it doesn't grow anymore. So that's typical symptoms of our root knot nematodes. Now, reniform is one we have in the South, and this is a tropical nematode, and it causes us a lot of trouble. As you see in the cotton field there, there's uneven plant growth, that wave effect, lots of open space. And on the right-hand side, that's the yields from that field later in the season. You see there's a lot of variation of what was actually produced. At the top is an interveinal chlorosis we see on our cotton leaves. Now this we see in Alabama, Georgia, and Florida, but not in Mississippi and Louisiana. So it's related to our soil types. But primarily our major symptom of this nematode is lower yields year after year. Now, reniform damage, the signs of this one, you can dig up those roots with a shovel, and you see in the top picture, you see all these root particles attached to the roof, to the root. If you wash them off very gently, and the bottom picture, you can see the posterior portion of the nematode outside the root. Her anterior portion is inside as she is feeding. But this works for us the first 2 weeks of June, and then after that, we have a very hard time finding the nematode on the root. But you can early in the season. Now with that, our best way to ever decide if we have a nematode problem is to take a sample and send it to the lab. As you see these two young men running through the field taking a sample. And we usually do random samples all through the lab with multiple cores to put them together to have your best chance to find the nematode. On the left-hand side, this is a line graph of the nematode numbers in our field. So you notice with the dates, or those are the months at the bottom of the chart, right before planting, our nematode numbers have plummeted. They're the smallest population we have. But then when we start planting our crops in May, then the populations jump as the crop grows. So when we have a biggest crop out there, that's the biggest nematode numbers we have. So you notice about harvest in October, the nematode numbers fall off again. So the time you take that sample makes a lot of difference of how many nematodes are actually out there. And just so you see, the various soil types that we have makes a lot of difference too, as you've heard previously. These are the six major soil types across Alabama. And as you look at the nematode populations as they increase over the season, so if you look, we start about 1,000 here, and the bottom green line shows you the very fine silty sandy loam, very fine sandy loam, and the nematodes only increase up to 10,000. But if you move up into the top line at the very top, that is a clay soil. It's a black belt clay. It's a heavier soil. And those reniform nematodes will go up to 70,000 nematodes in one season. So your soil type makes a lot of difference on what kind of nematode damage you're going to have as well. So I wanted to show you some data. This is our research station in the Tennessee Valley. So it's number one on the map. This station kindly let me inoculate the field where the red circle is, and that's the reniform field. So we added it to make sure also next to it is the white circle is the non-nematode field. It is clean. There is no reniform there. So we can actually look at the damage of this reniform nematode that you see underneath between the two fields where it is present and where it is not. We planted variety trials in those fields, as you see, for many years. And you notice I started the inoculations in 2007. By 2010, we were starting to see some significant yield reductions. In 2011, we had a tornado that took everything out. But back by 2013 and since then, you notice our yield losses between the two fields over the variety trials are anywhere from 39 to 66%. So that is how much yield the grower will lose if the nematode is present. Now, I have two nematicide slides to show you. So nematicide effects on the reniform egg numbers in these fields. You'll notice here, this is a population, and we do this about 40 days after planting. The blue bars are the varieties, which are listed at the bottom, and they are the nematode numbers just by the variety. The orange bars are the nematode numbers with the addition of a nematicide. And you do notice here, and this was 2017, we had a 92% reduction in the nematode numbers by using a nematicide. That was very helpful. This is very busy, I'm sorry, but these are the yields between these fields. So the first two bars show you the yields. The first bar is with the variety. The second bar is the yield with the variety and a nematicide, and that's in the no nematode field. There's not a nematode. So you saw a 2% increase in yield, and which is not much, and you don't need to add the nematicide if you don't have a nematode. But where we did have the nematode is the orange bar, the third one. That's the yield where the nematode was present. And the good news is the dark blue bar is where they added the seed treatment nematicide. And you do see a benefit from adding the nematicide. In this year, over all these varieties, that was a 48% increase in yield. That's our best case scenario. This is what it can look like, and this is in August, about 90 days after planting. This is a four-row plot. The two rows on the left have no nematicide, and they have that uneven growth. The two rows on the right, look at those plants. You can see the vigor, more uniform growth. However, we did this test for 4 years, and nematodes will vary tremendously with the environment. So we reduced nematode numbers 70% averaged over those 4 years by adding nematicide. But notice that varied from 32 to 92%. There's a lot of variability. The yield increase over 4 years was an 18%. And that varied from 4 with very little up to 48% on the good ones I showed you. That's a 577 pound of seed cotton increase in yield. But notice the variability. It does dramatically change year to year. So you will see variability in this potential for controlling the nematodes. So if we do have very high nematode numbers, we always suggest crop rotation. And I think down in the south, we have more options for that than they do up in the northern areas. So this is my common slide for this. We typically have cotton, soybean, and corn. Some people have the option of peanuts as well. And then you also see on the left are common names of our nematodes that we have here. Notice soybean, it's a host for everything. So it's a great crop, but all the nematodes love soybean. Cotton is not a host for the peanut root knot nor the soybean cyst. It's great. Corn does not host reniform or cyst, and that can be very helpful too. So this is my last slide here to show you this possibility. Even this is a root knot field. So even though you grow a susceptible crop, just changing that crop will help reduce your nematode numbers, at least for us in the South. So on the left-hand side, you're looking at cotton. We grew cotton for 2 years. The blue bar is cotton nematode numbers. Then the yellow bar shows you what nematode numbers if you switch to corn, and the green is soybean. So you notice on the left where we continued with cotton for the third year in a row, you go from 1,000 to 8,000 nematodes. But if you just switch to corn or soybeans, that population doesn't increase even half as much. In the middle, I believe we have the corn, and the center bar is the population of the third year of corn, and nematodes went from 1,000 to 4,000. But if you switch to blue cotton or green soybeans, you know you cut those populations in half. And on the right-hand side is soybean. So if we stayed with soybean, our root knot numbers went from 1,000 to 6,000. But switching just 1 year to corn or to cotton reduce those populations in half. So just that crop rotation can help keep your nematode numbers down. So with that, I'm going to the next slide. We wish you a very good season this next year. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kathy. So don't forget, if you have any questions for any of our speakers, feel free to type them into the chat box now. We have one more speaker before we hit our Q&A session, so we'll be addressing those then. Our final speaker for today is Dr. Tom Kroll. Tom has led the product and technical support at New Farm for 10 years, more recently leading the establishment of New Farm's seed treatment portfolio. For more than 30 years, Tom has been involved in fungicide, insecticide, and seed treatment product development, marketing, and sales management for an array of markets, including soybeans. He earned his doctorate in plant pathology from Virginia Tech. Thanks for joining us today, Tom, and I'll just let you take a whack at it.
Okay. Thank you, Alex, and thank you, Seed World, and thank you for previous speakers who have done a great job of outlining those problems that we have in the various crops. And I think that's great. We're going to focus now on a little bit on that seed treatment technology. And thank you to the previous speakers for setting up that stage to say that seed treatment technology is certainly an important tool in our use. Alex, are we advancing or not? There we go. All right. As noted by the previous speakers, nematodes are a persistent problem in some of our key crop commodities. And the question needs to be asked then is then what is needed in the nematicide to address the issues? To begin with, a product that manages nematode problems should perform on all key nematode species. It should be active in the targeted crops, and it should be consistent. And consistent control can be achieved through three primary modes of action. A material may be or may have a direct impact in killing the nematode. It may use the plant's natural defense systems in managing nematode penetration and colonization, or may provide a microbial barrier to the nematode through exterior colonization of the roots. And we'll look at that in a bit. Any product ultimately must meet today's criterion for being environmentally friendly. In addition, when implemented by the user, it should be safe to the worker, convenient to use, and compatible with the numerous products it can be mixed with. In summary of the previous presentations, this slide illustrates the key target crops and the nematodes that should be controlled. And as you've noted, that list even continues from what is presented here. But any product must be active on these pests and safe on the crop that it's used on. While it's not necessary for a product to be active in all markets on all pests, those products that do obviously allow for an optimum flexibility in the marketplace. And while a broad spectrum of activity is important, equally important is the consistency in performance. And for example, the graph on the left illustrates the average performance in controlling the relative damage to roots in corn. In turn, this performance in control most often corresponds to consistency in improved yield, as noted in the graph on the right. What's not illustrated here, but I think what's critically important though, is that seed treatments are not effective necessarily season long. And it's that initial impact that you're really getting the performance out of. So that early performance is key to consistently improved yields. And this is just another slide that illustrates the consistency and performance across these crops. And you can see, you know, differences in the impact, obviously. But I think the speakers have done a great job of saying that this is an additional tool that really adds to the performance or in controlling these nematodes. One of the primary means of control is through a direct impact to the nematodes. While there are several modes of actions that may be involved that can directly impact nematodes, the impact is in directly reducing the population of subsequent damage. Examples of these materials that impact nematode directly are Evicta, Olivo, and Nemastrike. Another way to manage the nematodes is through a stimulation of the plant's natural defenses, is in an environmentally sound method. As noted in this illustration, Trunemco stimulates plant genes that are responsible for a number of defense components in the plant. These include genes that regulate an increase in cell wall components, genes that regulate an increase in those compounds that are naturally toxic to nematodes, and genes that are responsible for the regulating of the plant's hypersensitive response to nematode infection. The overall impact is a stimulation of the plant's systemic defense that in turn keeps nematodes from penetrating and establishing within the root. This method allows for direct plant protection and an indirect impact on the nematode populations that are not able to build by feeding on the roots. Another environmentally sound method of nematode management is to supply an organism that colonizes the root surfaces and provides a barrier to nematode penetration of the root. Several products such as Votivo, Clariva, and Aveo employ this method of control. Trunemco is an example of one of those products that actually controls both this situation here, where you have the natural defenses, as well as the stimulating those natural defenses within the plant. So you have an inside and out type protection. And of course, in addition to all of this, the broad spectrum performance and meeting the current environmental demands for control, the product should also have qualities that make it easy to use. A low use rate, for example, is extremely important in a crop like soybeans. When you get into a situation where you have a combination of an insecticide, a fungicide, and an inoculant, And that doesn't leave much room for the nematicide. So the lower the rate, the better. Furthermore, having a caution signal word, for example, means that a product may be used with minimal protective clothing, which is obviously a key advantage if as you're treating. And since most of these blends include multiple fungicides, an insecticide, color, and polymer, any of these nematicides need to be compatible with these various components that are included in the mix. In summary, the optimal nematode management seed treatment should provide consistent, environmentally sound, broad spectrum activity. It should be safe and convenient to use and be compatible with the other tools that are used on the seed. And with that, again, thank you to all, and we'll turn it back over to you, Alice.
Thank you so much, Tom. So I think we have just about 15 minutes to tackle a Q&A session. So if you all have any last minute questions, please feel free to type them into the chat box now and I'll address them during this time. But to kick things off, Greg, actually our first question is for you. So our first question is PI88788. How weak has it become, and what's maybe in the genetic pipeline now to fight soybean cyst nematode?
Well, those are two good questions. PI88788 is, I should start off by saying resistance traditionally had been defined as allowing no more than 10% reproduction of the nematode. What we're seeing pretty commonly in Iowa, and I think representative across the upper Midwest, is not unusual to have SCN in fields where they can do 50% reproduction. So, I mean, in a crude kind of way, you can say 88788 has lost half its resistance, but the yield protection is better than 50%. So, PI88788 resistant beans can endure a fair amount of reproduction of the nematode without suffering terrible yield loss. So I don't want to paint too glib of a picture of PI88788. It's widely available. We can't refuse to use it. And so farmers are going to have to continue to use it. And I encourage farmers to look for the best ones by looking for data from university yield trials and seed company yield trials and so forth. Now, there are 30 or 40 varieties in the upper Midwest with the Peking resistance, and those used to not have as great a yield potential as varieties with PI88788, and they probably still don't have a higher yield potential if you grew them in a field with no nematodes or with the old version of soybean cyst nematode. But I just got done explaining that now many fields with SCN have 50% or 60% reproduction on 88788. So suddenly Peking's yield potential is a lot higher relative to 88788. So it is very useful if you can get seed as a farmer to grow varieties with Peking resistance. And then finally, the question about what's coming in the pipeline. There, we've known for decades there are lots of other sources of resistance. It's been hard to cross that resistance into good agronomic soybeans and maintain the yields. And probably the most success that's occurring right now are university scientists, Brian Deers and associates at University of Illinois, Melissa Mitchum at the University of Missouri. They've been working on new novel sources of resistance and getting them into high yielding varieties. And then furthermore, what I think is really progressive is studying different rotations in how to deploy those different types of resistance over sequences or years in rotation to see which ones are the most durable and the least likely to cause shifts and have the nematode build up on it. And we're doing some of that field testing at Iowa State University as well. So there's hope in the pipeline. You know, ultimately the seed companies have to adopt that resistance, but I think they're going to have more choices moving forward.
Super. Thanks so much, Greg. So this next question was talked about during Greg's section, but I'm going to let Tom take a stab at it. And Greg, if you have anything you'd like to add, feel free. But Our next question asks, how effective are seed treatments in controlling soybean cyst nematode? And is there something that we should look for in a treatment? Tom, I feel like you tackled this pretty well in your talk, but do you have a quick summary of that?
Well, I think, as Greg points out, it's a multifaceted approach because it's one of those things where, number one, you want to use your resistance, even if it's not complete. You want to rotate. Obviously, that's a key in all of this. But the seed treatments have proven time and again that they're when they're applied in those situations where you do have the nematode, it is certainly broadly effective. All of these materials are broadly effective. So I think that's the key, is that it's not the sole tool, but it's certainly a key tool in use. Greg, I don't know if you want to add any more to that, or?
No, not really, other than the other thing I sense is a tremendous interest in seed treatments among farmers because of the convenience factor as well. There's low amount of active ingredient per seed. It's easy to apply. It's applied at the time of planting. And those are some added benefits of delivering protection through seed treatments.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you all so much. Tamara, I think this question is for you. It was asked during your section, but it's a little bit broad. So this person wants to know, are there any pin nematodes that are also a problem for any of these crops? And I assume that is talking about soybeans, corn, or cotton.
Thank you for that question. You know, there are some species of pin nematode. In corn, they have not been an important problem. I don't believe they've been an important problem in soybean, and I'm unsure about cotton and other crops. So I would ask that my colleagues, Greg and Kathy, chime in, please, about pin nematode.
Sure. Pin, I get excited when I see it because I don't find it very often. So we haven't really had any problems in the South that I'm aware of.
Okay, super. Greg, did you have anything about pin nematodes in soybeans maybe?
No, I don't really have any firsthand experience with pin nematode on soybeans. And at the moment, at least, I can't even recall any published research that would kind of help with this discussion. So sorry.
Oh, no problem. Not at all. That's at least we have a little bit of information about it. Kathy, this next question is for you. So this question says, how do nematodes react to max temperatures? Because this question comes from someone who lives in Pakistan and is growing cotton in about 50 degrees Celsius weather.
Wow. Okay. Our nematodes do fine in the hot weather as long as there's moisture. Mm-hmm. So we tend to have quite a few nematodes as long as there's moisture, but we don't hit 50 C ever. We'll hit, and I'm not sure on my C's, we'll have 100 degree days for periods, but not any higher than that generally. But as long as there's moisture, the reniform does quite well, and so does the root knot. But in the 50 C is a little hotter than we are.
Okay, thank you so much, Kathy. Now, this next question I think is actually for everyone. So how about we start with Greg and go through our lineup? But for all the crops discussed today, is there a critical point in crop development where nematode control is really important?
Yeah, it would be early season, in my opinion, for soybean. I think back to published research with soil-applied nematicides, and that protection never lasted an entire season, but it would very often last long enough to get a good root system established for that crop. And as that protection wore off, or more accurately, as the roots grew away from the protection and the roots encountered nematodes, there was enough of a root system to sustain the plant growth through the season and produce profitable yields. And so it's a concept, early season protection, that could transfer in many respects to seed treatments and the protection that they provide as well. You got to get a good, healthy root system established early in the season, for soybeans at least, to set up for success later in the season.
Perfect. Thanks, Greg. Sorry, Tamara, Kathy, or Tom, do y'all have anything to add?
Well, this is Kathy in the South. We usually, as Greg has said, we call it the first 40 days. So typically we're always trying to protect that first 40 days and then our yields will be okay. So that's just our general saying down South.
Perfect.
And I would echo what my colleagues said, that early season infection seems to have the biggest impact on corn, although we don't have as much data in corn as we do in soybeans showing that early use of soil insecticides when we use some of the products that used to be effective against nematodes decades ago, that seemed to be the case, that they did work better when applied at planting versus later in the season.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
I might just add, I think that, as everyone's saying, the early is the important part of this. And I think this is where seed treatments have a great fit because it does provide that early protection. One of the things we find is that the chemicals can play out a little bit earlier than some of the microbials. So what's really nice is to apply that combination of the chemical plus the microbial that gives you an extended. And it's as Kathy suggests, I mean, it's within that, you know, around that 40-day window, because that's your crucial protection zone.
Perfect. Thanks so much, Tom. I think we have about enough time for just one more question for each of you. So I'd like to go around to each speaker just again in our lineup and say, if you had one piece of advice to share about managing nematodes to you know, maybe a grower or anyone looking to work on their management, what is one piece of advice you would give them?
Well, this is Greg. I'll go first since we've been going in this order, and that would be for soybean growers. I believe, become complacent about soybean cyst nematode. And so my advice would be to re-engage and become active in managing SCN again. And that includes pulling soil samples to monitor their numbers to see what's happening in their fields.
Awesome, thank you. Anyone else?
This is Tamara. I would just echo that. You don't know if you have a nematode problem or not until you collect that sample and submit that. And I think most labs are a pretty nominal fee to have that processed. $30-$40 will give you an answer that would help you apply maybe a better management strategy to that.
That sounds good. This is Kathy. I would also say if you have clean fields without nematodes, please be careful to not inoculate them. Once they're there, they're not going away, so you always have to manage them after that.
And my comments are the same as everyone else's, is number one, know your fields. And I think what I see is that a lot of folks just assume because they haven't seen symptoms in the foliage that the plants is fine, when in fact they may have an infestation of nematodes in that field, but they just simply haven't checked. So for the minimal cost, it's well worth checking to make certain, you know, what's present in that field and making that assessment on what the, you know, appropriate methods are then to control if there is a nematode problem.
Okay, well, thank you so much, everyone. I think that's about all the time we have today. So I'd like to thank our speakers one more time. Thank you, Greg, Tamara, Kathy, and Tom for joining us today. We'd also like to thank New Farm once more for partnering with us on today's webinar. And our final thank you goes out to everyone who participated in today's webinar. Thank you so much for your questions, and we hope you found this information of value. Just to remind everyone, a recording of this webinar will be made available later today or tomorrow morning at seedworld.com. And thanks again, and we hope you all have a just terrific day. This is Alex Martin of Seed World signing off.